This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents What She Knew, a novel by Jilly McMillan, performed by Penelope Rawlins and Dugald Bruce Lockhart.
Prologue. November 2013. 1 year after. Rachel. In the eyes of others, we're often not who we imagine ourselves to be. When we first meet someone, we can put our best foot forward and give the very best account of ourselves, but still get it horribly wrong. It's a pitfall of life. I've thought about this a lot since my son Ben went missing. And every time I think about it, it also begs the question, if we're not who we imagine we are, then is anybody else? If there's so much potential for others to judge us wrongly, then how can we be sure that our assessment of them in any way resembles the real person that lies underneath? You can see where my train of thought's going with this. Should we trust or rely on somebody just because they're a figure of authority or a family member? Are any of our friendships and relationships really based on secure foundations? If I'm in a reflective mood, I consider how different my life might have been if I'd had the wisdom to consider these things before Ben went missing. If my mood is dark, I find fault in myself for not doing so, and my thoughts, repetitive and paralyzing, punish me for days. A year ago, just after Ben's disappearance, I was involved in a press conference which was televised. My role was to appeal for help in finding him. The police gave me a script to read. I assumed people watching it would automatically understand who I was, that they would see I was a mother whose child was missing and who cared about nothing apart from getting him back. Many of the people who watched, the most vocal of them, thought the opposite. They accused me of terrible things. I didn't understand why until I watched the footage of the conference, far too late to limit the damage. But then the reason was immediately obvious. It was because I looked like prey. Not appealing prey, a wide-eyed antelope, say, tottering on spindly legs, but prey that's been well hunted, run ragged, and is near to the end. I presented the world with a face contorted by emotion and bloodied from injury, a body that was shaking with grief, and a voice that sounded as if it had been roughly scraped from a desiccated mouth. If I'd imagined beforehand that an honest display of myself and my emotions, however raw, might garner me some sympathy and galvanize people into helping me look for Ben, I was wrong. They saw me as a freak show. I frightened people because I was someone to whom the worst was happening, and they turned on me like a pack of dogs. I've had requests, since it was over, to appear again on television. It was a sensational case, after all. I always decline. Once bitten, twice shy. It doesn't stop me imagining how the interview might go, though. I envisage a comfortable TV studio and a kindly-looking interviewer, a man who says, "Tell us a little about yourself, Rachel." He leans back in his chair, which is set at a friendly angle to mine, as if we'd met for a chat in the pub. The expression on his face is the sort that someone might make if they were watching a cocktail being made for them, or an ice cream sundae, if that's your preference. We chat, and he takes time to draw me out, and lets me tell my side of the story. I sound okay. I'm in control. I conform to an acceptable view of a mother. My answers are well considered. They don't challenge. At no point do I spin a web of suspicion around myself by blurting out things that sounded fine in my head. I don't flounder and then sink. This is a fantasy that I can occupy long minutes of my time. The outcome is always the same. The imaginary interview goes really well. Brilliantly, in fact. And the best thing about it is that the interviewer doesn't ask me the question that I hate most of all. It's a question that a surprising number of people ask me. This is how they might phrase it. Before you discovered that Ben had disappeared, did you have any intuition that something bad would happen to him? I hate the question because it implies some kind of dereliction of duty on my part. It implies that if I were a more instinctive mother, a better mother, then I would have had a sense that my child was in danger, or should have done. How do I respond? I just say no. It's a simple enough answer, but people often look at me quizzically, brows furrowed in that particular expression where a desire to mind someone for gossip overwhelms sympathy for their plight. Softly crinkled foreheads and inquisitive eyes ask me, "Really? Are you sure? How can that be?" I never justify my answer. No, is all they need to know. I limit my answer because my trust in others has been eroded by what happened. Of course it has. Within many of my relationships, doubt remains like slivers of broken glass, impossible to see and liable to draw blood even after you thought you'd swept them all away. There are only a very few people that I know I can trust now, and they anchor me to my existence. They know the whole of my story. A part of me thinks that I would be willing to talk to others about what happened, but only if I could be sure that they'd listen to me. They'd have to let me get to the end of my tale without interrupting or judging me, and they'd have to understand that everything I did for Ben. Some of my actions were rash, some dangerous, but they were all for my son, because my feelings for him were the only truth I knew. If someone could bear to be the wedding guest to my ancient mariner, then in return for the gift of their time and their patience and their understanding, I would supply every detail. I think that's a good bargain. We all love to be thrilled by the vicarious experience of other people's ghastly lives, after all. Really, I've never understood why we haven't thought of an English word for schadenfreude. Perhaps we're embarrassed to admit that we feel it. Better to maintain the illusion that butter wouldn't melt in our collective mouths. My generous listener would no doubt be surprised by my story, because much of what happened went unreported. It would be just like having their very own exclusive. When I imagine telling this fictional listener my story, I think that I would start it by answering that hated question properly for the first time, because it's relevant. I would start the story like this. When Ben went missing, I didn't have any intuition. None whatsoever. I had something else on my mind. It was a preoccupation with my ex-husband's new wife.
Jim. Here's the list of everything I used to have under control. Work, relationship, family. Here's the problem I have now. The thoughts in my head. They remind me hourly, sometimes minute by minute, of loss, and of actions that can't be undone, however much you wish it. During the week I throw myself into work to try and erase these thoughts. Weekends are more of a challenge, but I've found ways to fill them too. I exercise, I work some more, and then I repeat. It's the nights that torment me, because then the thoughts revolve ceaselessly in my head and deny me sleep. When I was a student, I gained a little knowledge of insomnia. I studied surrealist poetry, and I read that sleep deprivation could have a psychedelic, hallucinogenic effect on the mind. That it had the potential to unleash reserves of creativity that were profound, and could enhance your life and your soul. My insomnia isn't like that. My insomnia makes a desperate, restless soul of me. There is no creativity, only hopelessness and frustration. Each night when I go to bed, I dread the inevitability of this, because when my head hits the pillow, however tired I am, however much I crave respite from my own mind, every single part of me seems to conspire to keep me awake. I become hyper-aware of all the potential stimuli around me, and each one feels like an affliction. My shifting movements make the smooth sheet beneath me buckle, and form ridges and channels like baked earth that's been torn into by the claws of an animal. If I try to lie still, my hands link together on my chest, then the pounding of my heart shortens my breath. If I lie without covers, the air in the room makes my skin prickle and crawl, whatever the temperature. Bundled up, I feel only an intense and overheated claustrophobia, which robs the air from my lungs and makes me sweat so that the bed feels like a stagnant pool that I'm condemned to bathe in. As I stew in my bed, I listen to the city outside. The shouting of strangers, cars, a moped, a siren, the rustle of treetops agitated by the wind. Sometimes nothing at all. A sound void. There are nights when this quiet torments me, and I rise, usually well beyond midnight, and I dress again, and then I walk the streets under the sodium orange glow of the streetlights, where the only life is a shadowy turbulence at the periphery of my vision. A fox, perhaps, or a broken man in a doorway. But even walking can't clear my mind completely, because as I put one foot in front of the other, I dread even more the return to the flat, to the bed, to its emptiness, to my wakefulness. And worst of all, I dread the thoughts that will circle once again in my mind. They take me straight to those dark, vivid places that I've worked so hard to lock away during the day. They find those hidden places, and they pick the locks, force the doors, pull away the planks of wood that have been nailed across the windows, and they let light into the dark corners inside. I think of it as harshly lit, like a crime scene. Center stage, Benedict Finch, his pellucid blue eyes meeting mine, and in them an expression so innocent that it feels like an accusation. Late into the small hours I sometimes get the sleep I crave, but the problem is that it's not a refreshing blackness, a chance for my mind to shut down. Even my sleep allows me no respite, because it's populated by nightmares. But whether I've been awake or asleep, when I rise in the morning, I'm often fettered and dehydrated, wrung out before the day has even begun. Tears might have dampened my pillow, and more often than not, sweat has soaked my sheets, and I face the morning with a sense of dread that my insomnia hasn't just blurred the boundaries between day and night, but has unbalanced me, too. I think, before it happened to me, that I might have underestimated both the restorative power of sleep and the destructive power of a shattered psyche. I didn't realize that exhaustion could bleed you dry so completely. I didn't realize that your mind could fall sick without you even noticing, incrementally, darkly, irrevocably. I'm too embarrassed to tell anybody else about these things, and the fact that the effects of my insomnia stay with me as day breaks, woven into the fabric of it. The exhaustion it breeds makes my coffee taste metallic, and the thought of food intolerable. It makes me crave a cigarette when I wake. It fuels my cycle ride to work with adrenaline so that I'm nervy, riding dangerously close to the curb, misjudging a junction so that the thud of a car forced into an emergency stop just behind me makes my legs pump painfully fast on the pedals. In the office, an early meeting. "Are you okay?" my DCI asks. I nod, but I can feel sweat breaking out along my hairline. "I'm fine," I say. I last for 10 minutes more until somebody asks, "What do you think, Jim?" I should relish the question. It's an opportunity to put myself forward, to prove myself. A year ago, I would have. Now I focus on the chipped plastic shard on the end of my biro. Through the pall of my exhaustion, I have to force myself to raise my head and look at the three expectant faces around me. All I can think about is how the insomnia has smeared the clarity of my mind. I feel panic spreading through my body as if it's being infused like a drug, pushing through arteries, veins, and capillaries until it incapacitates me. I leave the room silently, and once I'm outside, I pound my fist into the wall until my knuckles bleed. It's not the first time it's happened, but it's the first time they make good on their threat to refer me to a psychologist. Her name is Dr. Francesca Minelli. They make it clear that if I don't attend all sessions and contribute positively to the discussions with Dr. Minelli, then I'm out of CID. We have a preliminary meeting. She wants me to write a report on the Benedict Finch case. I start it by writing down my objections. Report for Dr. Francesca Minelli on the events surrounding the Benedict Finch case by D.I. James Clemo, Avon and Somerset Constabulary. Confidential. I'd like to start this report by formally noting down the objection that I have both to writing it and to attending therapy sessions with Dr. Minelli. While I believe that the Force Occupational Health Service is a valuable asset, I also believe that the use of it should be discretionary for officers and other staff. I should be raising this objection formally through the proper channels. I recognise that the purpose of the report is to describe the events that occurred during the investigation of the Benedict Finch case from my own point of view. This will provide the basis for discussion between myself and Dr. Minnelli, with the aim of ascertaining whether it will be useful for me to have long-term support from her in dealing with some of the issues that arose from my involvement in that case, and some personal issues that affected me at around that time also. I understand that I should include details of my personal life, where relevant, including where it relates to DC Emma Chang, as this will allow Dr. Minnelli to form a whole view of my decision-making processes and motivations during the period that the case was live. The progress of my report will be reviewed by Dr. Minnelli as it's written, and what I produce each week will form the basis for my talking sessions with Dr. Minnelli. Dr. Minnelli has advised that the bulk of this report should be a description of my personal recollections of what took place, though it may also include transcripts of our conversations or other material where she feels that is appropriate. I agree to do this only on the understanding that the contents of this report will remain confidential. D.I. James Clemo.
Before. Day 1. Sunday, the 21st of October, 2012. In the UK, a child is reported missing every 3 minutes. www.missingkids.co.uk. The first 3 hours are most critical when trying to locate a missing child. www.missingkids.com/keyfacts. Rachel. My ex-husband's name is John. His new wife is called Katrina. She's petite. She has a figure that can make most men drink her in with their eyes. Her deep brown hair always looks shiny and freshly coloured, like hair in magazines. She wears it in a bob, and it's always carefully styled around her pixie face, framing a pert mouth and dark eyes. When I first met her at a hospital function that John was hosting, months before he left us, I admired those eyes. I thought they were lively and sparky. They flashed around the room, assessing and flirting, teasing and charming. After John had gone, I thought of them as magpie's eyes, darting and furtive, foraging for other people's treasure to line her nest. John walked out of our family home on Boxing Day. For Christmas, he'd given me an iPad and Ben a puppy. I thought the gifts were thoughtful and generous, until I watched him back his car out of the driveway on Boxing Day, neatly packed bags stowed on the back seat, while the ham went cold on the dining table and Ben cried because he didn't understand what was happening. When I finally turned and went back into the house to start my new life as a single mother, I realized that they were guilt gifts. Things to fill the void he would leave in our lives. They certainly occupied us in the short term, but perhaps not as John intended. The day after Boxing Day, Ben appropriated the iPad, and I spent hours standing under an umbrella in the garden, shivering, shocked, while the new Kath Kidston Christmas slippers my sister had sent me got rain-soaked and muddy, and the puppy worked relentlessly to pull up a clematis when I should have been encouraging it to pee. Katrina lured John away from us just 10 months before Ben disappeared. I thought of it as a master plan that she executed, the seduction and theft of my husband. I didn't know the detail of how they kindled their affair, but to me it felt like a plot from a bad medical drama. He had the real-life role of consultant pediatric surgeon. She was a newly qualified nutritionist. I imagined them meeting at a patient's bedside, eyes locking, hands grazing, a flirtation that turned into something more serious, until she offered herself to him unconditionally, the way you can before you have a child to consider. At that time, John was obsessed with his work. It consumed him, which makes me think that she must have done most of the running, and that the package she offered him must have amounted to a seductive proposition indeed. I was bitter about it. My relationship with John had such solid and careful beginnings that I'd assumed it would last forever. It simply never occurred to me that there could be a different kind of ending for us, which was I now realise, extremely naive. What I hadn't realised was that John didn't think like me. That he didn't view any problems we might have had as normal, surmountable. For him, things boiled under the surface, until he couldn't cope with being with me any more, and his solution was just to up and leave. When I rang my sister right after he'd gone, she said,
"Didn't you have any idea at all?"
And her voice was strained with disbelief.
"Are you sure you paid him enough attention?"
was her next question, as if the fault was mine, and that was to be expected. I hung up the phone. My friend Laura said,
"I thought he was a bit detached lately. I just assumed you guys were working through it."
Laura had been my closest friend since we were at nursing college together. Like me, she hadn't stuck with bedpans and body fluids. She'd quit and switched to journalism instead. We'd been friends for long enough that she'd witnessed the birth and growth of my relationship with John, as well as its demise. She was observant and forthright. That word, detached, stayed with me. Because, if I'm being really honest, I hadn't noticed it. When you have a child to look after, and when you're busy developing a new career as well, you sometimes don't. The separation and divorce tore me apart, I'll admit to that. When Ben disappeared, I was still in mourning for my husband. In 10 months, you can get used to some of the mechanics of being alone, but it takes longer for the hurt to heal. I went round to Katrina's flat once, after he'd moved in with her. It wasn't difficult to find. I pressed on her door buzzer, and when she answered the door, I snapped. I accused her of being a homewrecker, and I might have said worse things. John wasn't there, but she had friends round, and as our voices rose, the three of them appeared behind her, mouths open, aghast. They were a perfectly groomed Greek chorus of disapproval. Glasses of white wine in hand, they watched me rage. It wasn't my finest hour, but I never got quite round to apologising. You might wonder what I look like if my husband could be lured away by such a pert little magpie. If you saw the press conference footage, you'll already have an idea, though I wasn't at my best, obviously. You'll have seen that my hair looked straggly and unkempt, in spite of my sister's efforts to tame it. It looked like witch's hair. Would you believe me if I said that under normal circumstances it's one of my best features? I have long, wavy, dark blonde hair that falls beneath my shoulders. It can be nice. You'll certainly have noticed my eyes. That's the close-up shot they replay most. Bloodshot, desperate, pleading eyes, red-rimmed and puffy from the tears I'd shed. You're going to have to take my word for it that normally my eyes look pretty. They're wide and very green, and I used to think they flattered my pale, clear skin. But what I really hope you noticed was the smattering of freckles across my nose. Did you see those? Ben inherited them from me, and it always pleased me beyond measure to see that physical trace of myself in him. It would be wrong of me to give you the impression that the only thing I was thinking about was Katrina when Ben disappeared. On the afternoon when it happened, Ben and I were walking the dog in the woods. It was a Sunday, and we'd driven out of Bristol and across the Clifton Suspension Bridge to reach the countryside beyond. The bridge traversed the Avon Gorge, a great crevice in the landscape carved out by the muddy-banked River Avon, which Ben and I could see flooding its basin far below, brown and swollen at high tide. The gorge was the boundary between city and countryside. The city hugged one side of it, teetering on its edges, and the woods hugged the other, trees running densely hundreds of feet down steep cliffs until they petered out beside the riverbank. Once we'd crossed the bridge, it only took us 5 minutes to be parked and loose in the woodland. It was a beautiful late autumn afternoon, and as we walked, I was relishing the sounds and smells and sights it offered. I'm a photographer. It's a career change I made when I had Ben. I walked away from my previous incarnation as a nurse without a single regret. Photography was a joy, an absolute passion of mine, and it meant that I was always looking at the light, thinking about how I could use it in a photograph. And I can remember exactly what it was like as we walked that afternoon. It was fairly late, so what light remained had a transient quality to it, and there was just enough brightness in the air that the colours of the leaves above and around me appeared complex and beautiful. Some of them fell as we walked. Without a whisper of protest, they let go of the branches that had sustained them for months and drifted down in front of us to settle on the woodland floor. When we began our walk, it was still a gentle afternoon, allowing the change of seasons to unfold quietly and gradually around us. Of course, Ben and the dog were oblivious to it. While I composed photographs in my mind, both of them, with misty breath and bright, wild eyes, ran and played and hid. Ben wore a red anorak, and I saw it flash down the path in front of me, then weave in and out of the trees. Skittle ran by his side. Ben threw sticks at tree trunks, and he knelt close to the leaf-strewn ground to examine mushrooms that he knew not to touch. He tried to walk with his eyes closed, and kept up a running commentary on how that felt.
"I think I'm in a muddy part, Mum," he said,
as he felt his boot get stuck, and I had to rescue it while he stood with a socked foot held precariously in the air. He picked up pine cones and showed me one that was closed up tight.
"It's going to rain,"
he told me.
"Look!"
My son looked beautiful that afternoon. He was only 8 years old. His sandy hair was tousled and his cheeks were pink from exertion and cold. He had blue eyes that were clear and bright as sapphires. He had pale winter skin, perfectly unblemished except for those freckles, and a smile that was my favourite sight in the world. He was about two-thirds my height, just right for me to rest an arm around his shoulders as we walked, or to hold his hand, which he was still happy for me to do from time to time, though not at school. That afternoon, Ben exuded happiness in that uncomplicated way children can. It made me feel happy, too. It had been a hard 10 months since John left us, and although I still thought about him and Katrina more than I probably should have, I was also experiencing moments of all-rightness, times when it felt okay that it was just Ben and I. They were rare, if I'm honest, but they were there all the same. And that afternoon in the woods was one of those moments. By 4:30, the cold was beginning to bite, and I knew we should start to make our way home. Ben didn't agree.
"Can I have a go on the rope swing, please?"
"Yes," I said. "I reckoned we could still be back at the car before it got dark."
"Can I run ahead?"
I often think back to that moment. And before you judge me for the reply I gave him, I want to ask you a question. What do you do when you have to be both a mother and a father to your child? I was a single parent. My maternal instincts were clear. Protect your child from everything. My maternal voice was saying, "No, you can't. You're too young. I want to take you to the swing, and I want to watch you every step of the way." But in the absence of Ben's dad, I thought it was also my responsibility to make room in my head for another voice, a paternal one. I imagined that this voice would encourage Ben to be independent, to take risks, to discover life himself. I imagined it saying, "Of course you can. Do it." So, here's how the conversation actually went.
"Can I run ahead?"
"Oh, Ben, I'm not sure."
"Please, Mom."
The vowels were strung out, wheedling.
"Do you know the way?" "Yes."
"Are you sure?"
"We do it every time."
He was right, we did. "Okay. But if you don't know where to find the track, just stop and wait for me on the main path."
"Okay,"
and he was off, careering down the path ahead of me, Skittle racing with him.
Ben!
I shouted.
Are you sure you know the way? Yes!
He shouted, with the assurance of a kid who almost certainly hasn't bothered to listen to what you said, because they have something more exciting to be getting on with. He didn't stop or look back at me. And that was the last I saw of him. As I walked the path behind Ben, I listened to a voicemail on my phone. It was from my sister. She'd left it at lunchtime.
Hi, it's me. Can you give me a ring about the Christmas photo shoot for the blog? I'm at the Cotswold Food Festival, and I've got loads and loads of ideas that I want to chat to you about. So I just want to confirm that you're still coming up next weekend. I know we said you should come and stay at home, but I thought we could do something better at the cottage. Dress it up with holly and stuff. So why don't you come there instead? The girls will stay with Simon as they've all got things to do, so it'll be just us. And by the way, I'm staying there tonight, so try me there if you can't get through on my mobile. Love to Ben. Bye.
My sister had a very successful food blog. It was called Ketchup and Custard, named after her daughter's favourite foods. She had four girls, each one the image of their father with deep brown eyes and hair that was so dark it was nearly black, and stubborn, willful temperaments. My sister often joked that if she hadn't given birth to them herself, she'd have questioned whether they belonged to her at all. And I admit, I sometimes wondered if my sister ever truly got the measure of her girls. They seemed such an impenetrable bunch, even to their mother. Close in age, all of them older than Ben, they formed a little tribe that Ben never quite managed to penetrate. And in fact, he regarded them with some wariness, mostly because they treated him a bit like a toy. Nikki proved a match for them more often than not, though, scheduling and organizing them down to the last minute, dominating them by keeping them busy. Their lives ran to such a strict routine that I sometimes wondered if these raven-haired girls wouldn't implode once they entered the real world, beyond their mother's control. On her blog, Nikki posted recipes that she claimed would make even the fussiest families eat healthily and eat together. When she started the blog, I thought it was naff and silly, but to my surprise it had taken off, and she was often mentioned when newspapers published top 10 lists of good food or family blogs. My sister was a brilliant cook, and she combined recipes with good-humoured writing about the trials of raising a big family. It wasn't my cup of tea, too contrived and twee by far, but it was impressive, and it seemed to strike a chord with lots of women who bought into the domestic heroine ideal. I called her back, left a message in return. Yes, we're planning to come up on Saturday morning and leave after lunch on Sunday. Do you want me to bring anything? I was making a point by asking that. I knew she wouldn't want anything from me. She prided herself on being a perfect hostess. Limiting our stay was also deliberate. When I'd thought we were going to visit Nikki at their family home, I'd been determined to stay only one night, because although Nikki was the only family I had, and I felt a duty to see her and to give Ben the chance to get to know his cousins, it was never something I looked forward to especially. Their big house just outside Salisbury was always perfectly presented, traditional and loud, and it became claustrophobic after one night. I simply found the whole package a bit overwhelming. Super-efficient Nikki working domestic miracles, left, right and centre. Her big, jolly husband, glass of wine in hand, and pile of anecdotes at the ready. And the daughters, bickering, flicking V-signs at my sister's back, wrapping their father around their little fingers. It was a world apart from my quiet life with Ben in our small house in Bristol. Not that the cottage was my ideal destination either, even without Nikki's family to contend with. Left to both Nikki and me by our Aunt Esther, who raised us, it was small and damp and held slightly uncomfortable memories for me. I would have sold it years ago. I could certainly have done with the money. But Nikki remained very attached to it, and she and Simon had long since taken on its maintenance costs entirely. largely out of guilt, I think, that she wouldn't let me release the capital in it. She encouraged me to make more use of it, but somehow time spent there left me feeling odd, as if I somehow had never grown up properly, never shared my teenage self. I slipped my phone back into my pocket. I'd reached the start of the path that led to the rope swing. Ben wasn't there, so I assumed he'd gone ahead of me. I made my way along in his wake, squelching through mud and batting away brambles. When I came to the clearing where the rope swing was, I was smiling in anticipation of seeing him, and of enjoying his triumph at having got there himself. Except that he wasn't there, and nor was Skittle. The rope swing was in motion, moving from left to right and back again in a slow rhythm. I pushed forward to give myself a wider view of the clearing.
"Ben!"
I called. No reply. I felt a flash of panic, but told myself to stop it. I'd given him this little bit of independence, and it would be a shame to mar the moment by behaving in an over-anxious way. Ben was probably hiding behind a tree with Skittle, and I shouldn't wreck his game. I looked around. The clearing was small, no bigger than half a tennis court. Dense woodland wrapped around most of it, darkening the perimeters, although on one side a large crop of medium-sized saplings grew, spindly and brittle, leafless. They dispersed the light around them, lending it a quality of strangeness. In the middle of the clearing stood a mature beech tree, which overhung a small brook. The rope swing was tethered to one of its branches. I reckoned that Ben was hiding behind its thick trunk. I walked slowly into the clearing, playing along with him.
"Hmm,"
I said, throwing my voice in the direction of the tree so that he could hear me.
"I wonder where Ben is. I thought he was meeting me here, but I can't see him anywhere. Or that dog of his. It's a mystery."
I stopped to listen, to see if he would give himself away, but there was no sound.
"I wonder if Ben has gone home without me,"
I continued, dipping a booted toe into the brook. The motion of the swing had ceased now, and it hung limply.
"Maybe," I said, drawing the word out. "Ben has started a new life in the woods without me. And I'll just have to go home and eat honey on toast by myself and watch Doctor Who on my own."
Again, no response, and the flutter of fear returned. This kind of talk was usually enough to make him emerge, triumphant at having tricked me for so long. I told myself to be calm, that he was upping the stakes, making me work hard. I said,
"Well, I guess that if Ben is going to live on his own in the woods, then I'll just have to give away his things so that another boy can have them."
I sat down on a moss-covered tree stump to wait for his response, trying to play it cool. Then I delivered my trump card.
"I just wonder who would like to have Baggy Bear."
Baggy Bear was Ben's favourite toy, a teddy that his grandparents had given him when he was a baby. I looked around, expecting him to emerge, half laughing, half cross. But there was absolute silence, as if the woodland was holding its breath. In the quiet, my eyes followed the lines of the surrounding tree trunks upwards until I glimpsed the sky above, and I could feel darkness starting to push in as surely as fire creeps across a piece of paper, curling its edges, turning it to ash. In that moment, I knew that Ben wasn't there. I ran to the tree. I circled it once, twice, again, feeling its bark scrape my fingers as I went round.
"Ben!"
I called.
"Ben! Ben! Ben!"
No response. I kept calling, on and on. And when I stopped to listen, straining to hear, there was still nothing. A sickening feeling in my gut pinched harder as each second passed. then a noise. A wonderful, glorious crashing sound. The sound of someone rushing through undergrowth. It was coming from the glade of saplings. I ran towards it, picking my way through the young trees as quickly as I could, dodging low, whippy branches, feeling one of them slice into my forehead.
Ben!
I shouted.
I'm here!
No response, but the noise got closer.
I'm coming, love!
I called. Relief surged through me. As I ran, I scanned the dense growth ahead of me to try to catch a glimpse of him. It was hard to tell exactly where the noise was coming from. Sounds were ricocheting around amongst the trees, confusing me. It shocked me when something burst out of the undergrowth beside me. It was a dog, and it was big and happy to see me. It bounced at my feet, eager to be petted, its mouth wide and dark red, startlingly so, its big fleshy tongue lolling. A few yards behind it, a woman emerged from the trees.
"I'm so sorry, dear," she said. "He won't hurt you. He's very friendly."
"Oh, God," I said.
I cupped my hands around my mouth.
"Ben!"
I shouted, and this time I yelled so loudly that it felt as if the cold air was scorching my throat when I drew breath.
"Have you lost your dog? He's not that way, or I'd have come across him. Oh, did you know your forehead is bleeding? Are you all right? Hold on a minute."
She fumbled in her coat pocket and offered me a tissue. She was elderly and wore a waxed hat with a wide brim that was pulled low on her head. Her face was creased with concern, and she was short of breath. I ignored the tissue, and instead I grasped her, my fingers sinking into her padded jacket until I felt the resistance of her arm beneath. She flinched.
"No,"
I said.
"It's my son. I've lost my son."
As I spoke, I felt a bead of blood trickle down my forehead. And so it began. We hunted for Ben, the lady and I. We scoured the area around the rope swing and then returned to the path, striking out along it in opposite directions, with a plan to converge at the main car park. I wasn't calm, not a bit. Fear made my insides feel as if they were melting. As we searched, the woods were transforming. The sky became darker and overcast, and in places, the overhanging branches were dense enough to form a solid arch, and the path became a dark burrow. Leaves gusted around me like decomposing confetti as the wind began to build, and great masses of foliage shuddered and bent as it whipped through the canopy above. I called for Ben over and over again, and listened too, straining to decipher the layers of sound the woods produced. A branch cracked. A bird called. A high-pitched sound, like a yelp, and another answered. High overhead was the sound of an aeroplane. Loudest of all was me. My breathing, the sound of my boots slapping through the mud. My panic was audible. Nowhere was the sound of Ben's voice, or of Skittle. Nowhere did I see a bright red anorak. By the time I reached the car park, I felt hysterical. It was packed with cars and families, because there were teams of boys and their supporters leaving the adjacent soccer field. A fantasy role-play enactment group loitered in one corner, bizarrely costumed, packing weaponry and picnic coolers into their cars. They were a regular sight in the woods on Sunday afternoons. I focused on the boys. Many of them wore red kit. I moved amongst them looking for him, turning shoulders, staring into faces, wondering if he was there, camouflaged by his anorak. I recognized some faces amongst them. I called his name, asked them if they'd seen a boy, asked them if they'd seen Ben Finch. A hand on my arm stopped me in my tracks.
"Rachel!"
It was Peter Armstrong, single dad of Ben's best friend, Finn. Finn stood behind him in a football kit, mud-streaked, sucking on a piece of orange.
"What's happened?"
Peter listened as I told him.
"We need to phone the police," he said. "Right now."
He made the call himself while I stood beside him, shaking, and couldn't believe what I was hearing because it meant that this was real now. This was actually happening to us. Then Peter organized people. He rallied the families in the car park and got some to stay behind with the children, others to form a search party.
5 minutes,
he said to everyone.
Then we leave.
As we waited, raindrops began to speckle the front of Peter's glasses. I trembled, and he put his arm around me.
It'll be okay,
he said.
We'll find him.
We were standing like that when the old lady emerged from the woods. She was out of breath, and her dog strained at its lead. Her face fell when she saw me.
Oh, my dear, she said. I'm so sorry. I was sure you would have found him by now.
She laid a hand on my arm for support as much as reassurance.
Have you called for help?
She asked.
As it's getting dark, I think you must.
It didn't take long, but even so, by the time everyone had mustered, the shadows and shapes of the trees around us had lost their definition and merged into indistinct shades of darkness, making the woods seem impenetrable and hostile. Anybody who had one brought a flashlight. We were a motley crew who gathered. A mixture of football parents, reenactors still in costume, and a lycra-clad cyclist. Our pinched faces told not just of the deepening chill, but of the darker and growing fear that Ben wasn't just lost, but that he'd come to harm. Peter addressed everybody.
Ben's wearing a red anorak, blue trainers that flash, jeans, and he's got dark brown hair and blue eyes. The dog's a black and white cocker spaniel called Skittle. Any questions?
There were none. We broke into two groups and set off, one in each direction along the path. Peter led one group, I led the other. The woods swallowed us up. Before 10 minutes had passed, the rain worsened and great fists of water broke through the canopy. Within minutes, we were wet through, and large, spreading puddles appeared on the path. Our progress slowed dramatically, but we carried on calling and listening, the beams of the torches swinging wide and low into the woodland around us, eyes straining to see something, anything. As each second passed and the weather pressed in around us, my fear built into a hot, urgent thing that threatened to explode inside me. After 20 minutes, I felt my phone vibrate. It was a text from Peter.
Meet car park,
it said, and that was all. Hope surged. I began to run faster and faster, and when I emerged from the path and into the car park, I had to stop abruptly. I was in the full glare of a pair of headlights. I shielded my eyes.
Rachel Jenner?
A figure stepped into the beam, silhouetted.
Yes? I'm WPC Sarah Banks. I'm a police constable from Nailsea Police Station. I understand your son is lost. Any sign of him?
No.
Nothing at all?
I shook my head. A shout went up from behind us. It was Peter. He had Skittle cradled in his arms. He gently laid the dog down. One of Skittle's delicate hind legs was at a painful, unnatural angle. He whimpered when he saw me and buried his nose into my hand.
Ben?
I asked. Peter shook his head.
The dog hobbled onto the path right in front of us. We've no idea where he came from.
My memories of that moment are mostly of sound and sensation. The rain wet on my face, soaking my knees as I knelt on the ground. Grim murmurs from the people gathered around. The soft whimpering of my dog. The wild gusting of the wind and the faint sound of pop music coming from one of the cars that the kids had sheltered in, its windows all steamed up. Cutting through everything was the crackle of the police radio just behind me, and the voice of WPC Banks calling for assistance. Peter took the dog away to the vet. WPC Banks refused to let me go back into the woods. With her sharp young features and neat white little teeth, She looked too immature to be authoritative, but she was adamant. We sat in my car together. She questioned me closely about what Ben and I had been doing, where I'd last seen him. She took slow, careful notes in bulbous handwriting, which looked like fat caterpillars crawling across the page. I rang John. When he answered, I began to cry, and WPC Banks gently took my mobile from me and asked him to confirm that he was Ben's dad. Then she told him that Ben was lost, and that he should come right away to the woods. I rang my sister, Nikki. She didn't answer at first, but she called me back quickly.
"Ben's lost,"
I said. It was a bad line. I had to raise my voice.
"What?"
"Ben's lost."
"Lost? Where?"
I told her everything. I confessed that I'd let him run ahead of me, that it was my fault. She took a no-nonsense approach.
"Have you called the police? Have you organized people to search? Can I speak to the police?"
"They're bringing dogs, but it's dark, so they say they can't do anything more until morning."
"Can I speak to them?"
"There's no point."
"I'd like to."
"They're doing everything they can."
"Shall I come?"
I appreciated the offer. I knew my sister hated driving in the dark. She was a nervous driver at the best of times, cautious and conservative on the road, as in life. The routes around our childhood cottage, where she was staying for the night, were treacherous even in daylight. In the depths of rural Wiltshire, on the edge of a large forested estate, the cottage was accessible only via a network of narrow, winding lanes, edged with deep ditches and tall hedges.
"No, it's okay. John's on his way."
"You must ring me if there's any news, anything."
"I will."
"I'll stay out by my phone."
"Okay."
"Is it raining there?"
"Yes. It's so cold. He's only wearing an anorak and a cotton top."
Ben hated to wear jumpers. I'd got him into one that afternoon before we left for the woods, but he'd wriggled out of it once we were in the car.
"I'm hot, Mum,"
he'd said.
"So hot."
The jumper, red, knitted, lay on the back seat of my car, and I leant back and pulled it onto my lap, held it tight, smelled him in its fabric. Nikki was still talking, reassuring, as she usually did, even when her own anxiety was building.
"It's okay. It won't take them long to find him. He can't have gone far. Children are very resilient."
"They won't let me search for him. They're making me stay in the car park."
"That makes sense. You could injure yourself in the dark."
"It's nearly his bedtime."
She exhaled. I could imagine the creases of worry on her face and the way she'd be gnawing at her little fingernail. I knew what Nikki's anxiety looked like. It had been our constant companion as children.
"It'll be okay," she said.
But we both knew they were only words, and that she didn't know that for sure. When John arrived, WPC Banks spoke to him first. They stood in the beam of John's headlights. The rain was relentless still, heavy and driving. Above them, a huge beech tree provided some shelter. It had hung on to enough of its leaves that its underside, illuminated by the lights from the car, looked like a golden corona. John was intently focused on what WPC Banks was saying. He exuded a jumpy, fearful energy. His hair, usually the colour of wet sand, was plastered blackly around the contours of his face, which were pallid, as if they'd been sculpted from stone.
"I've spoken to my inspector," WPC Banks was telling him. "He's on his way."
John nodded. He glanced at me, but moved his eyes quickly away. The tendons in his neck were taut.
"That's good news," she said. "It means they're taking it seriously."
Why wouldn't they? I wondered. Why wouldn't they take a missing child seriously? I stepped towards John. I wanted to touch him, just his hand, Actually, I wanted him to hold me. Instead, I got a look of disbelief.
You let him run ahead,
he said, and his voice was stretched thin with tension.
What were you thinking?
I'm sorry, I said. I'm so sorry.
There was no point in trying to give him an explanation. It was done. I would regret it forever. WPC Banks said,
I think for now it would be best if all of our focus is on the search for Ben. It won't do him any good if you cast blame.
She was right. John understood that. He was blinking back tears. He looked distraught and incredulous. I watched him cycle through everything I'd been feeling since Ben had gone. He had question after question, each of which WPC Banks answered patiently until he was satisfied that he knew everything there was to know and that everything possible was being done. As I stood beside him and let WPC Banks reassure him, I realized that it had been more than 10 months since I'd seen him smile. And I wondered if I ever would again.
Jim. Addendum to D.I. James Clemo's report for Dr. Francesca Manelli. Transcript recorded by Dr. Francesca Manelli, D.I. James Clemo, and Dr. Francesca Manelli in attendance. Comments to indicate observations on D.I. Clemo's state of mind or behaviour, where his remarks alone do not convey this, are also included. This transcript is from the first full psychotherapy session that D.I. Clemo attended. Previous to this, we had only a short, preliminary meeting where I took a history from D.I. Clemo and we discussed the report that I had asked him to write. Predictably, given his resistant attitude to therapy, the report that D.I. Clemo submitted at this stage was lacking in comment on areas of his personal and emotional experience at the time of the Benedict Finch case. The transcripts fill in the gap somewhat. My priority in this first session was to begin to establish D.I. Clemo's trust in me. D.I. Clemo elected to see me at my private consultation rooms based in Clifton, rather than at the facility provided at Police HQ. Good to see you again. Thank you for making a start on your report. D.I. James Clemo acknowledges this comment with a terse nod. He hasn't yet spoken. I've noted your objection to continuing to attend these sessions with me. He makes no comment. He's also avoiding eye contact. So I'd like to start by asking whether there have been any more incidents. Incidents? Panic attacks? Of the sort that led to your referral to me? No. Can you describe to me what happened on the two occasions that you experienced the panic attacks? I can't just come in here and talk about stuff like that. It would be helpful to have more detail, just to get us started. What triggered the feelings of panic? How they grew into a full-blown attack? What were you feeling while it happened? I'm not talking about my feelings, it's not what I do. I'm sick of the way feelings are all anybody wants to talk about. Watching any sport on TV these days, that's all the commentators ask people. Sue Barker talking to a guy who's played tennis for 4 hours, or collaring someone who's just lost the most important football game of his life. How are you feeling? What about how did you do it? How hard have you worked to get here? Do you think that expressing feelings is a weakness? Yes, I do. Is that why you don't like talking about the panic attacks? Because they might have been prompted by some very strong feelings that you had? He doesn't reply. Everything you say in here will remain confidential, but you'll make a decision about whether I'm fit to work. I'll report back to your DCI and make a recommendation, but nobody else will see the contents of your report or the transcripts of our conversations. Those are for my use only. They'll form the basis of our ongoing conversations. This is going to be a long process, and if you can work towards being open with me, we have a much greater chance of success, and we can hopefully get you back out there doing the work you want to do. I'm a detective. It's in my blood. It's what I live for. You need to be aware also that the number of psychotherapy sessions that your DCI is prepared to fund is limited. I know that. Then talk to me. He takes his time. At first, it was like being winded. I couldn't get a proper breath in. I kept yawning and breathing, trying to get air, trying to stop the dizziness, because I thought I was going to pass out. Then my heart was pounding really fast, and I stopped being able to think. Couldn't get my mind